Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi there, I'm Janet. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what is a podcast?
It's like the radio, but there's no music, and literally anyone can do one at any moment about any subject. And there's a billion of them.
Sounds great. Hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today we're talking about Chapter 5, Category 55 Emergency Doomsday Crisis, written by Matt Murray, including guest cast Steve Berg, John Hartman, Monet Michael, Rebecca Hazelwood, Anna Kaja, Ajay Mehta, Lynette Gaza, Jill Johnson, Yanelli Ireland, and Grace N. Pullapalli. Eleanor surprises herself with her first selfless action, but she finds Chidi is avoiding her. Tahani is upset to find out she has a low neighborhood ranking. Michael puts the neighborhood on lockdown due to the expanding sinkhole. Eleanor and Chidi are fighting when Michael asks them to take in another couple, Bart and Nina. Tahani goes into brunch hosting overdrive to increase her ranking. Bart and Nina pry at Chidi and Eleanor's tension. Chidi divulges that he's upset because he never had a soulmate on Earth. Eleanor apologizes for the situation and gives Chidi a card he can use to get her to fork off whenever he feels overburdened. Michael ends the lockdown due to the fixed sinkhole, but confides in Eleanor that he has no idea what happened and that they're going to further investigate. There's a flashback in which Tahani is repeatedly upstaged by her sister Camilla in their quests for their parents' affection. My guests today are executive producer and director of this episode, Morgan Sackett, and some good person, Kristen Bell. Kristen and Morgan, welcome. Everything is fine.
Hello, idiot.
Hello, morons. We're recording this in between scenes for you today, Kristen. We're in the building that sometimes doubles as a cafeteria for lunch.
It's our lunchroom.
On the Universal lot. We are also just across the hall from the room where you recorded the video of Darcy and Jamila and Manny and Will learning the episode 113 twist.
Yes.
Did you know that you wanted to record that?
Oh, from the moment Mike pitched me the show, I knew I would want to record anyone who found out this twist who didn't know about it. He actually let me butt in on that meeting because he said, I'm going to tell them after lunch. I'm going to take a 20-minute powwow and I'm going to tell them after lunch. I said, oh, can I come? And he said, sure. And then I just sat ominously behind him with my camera open, which I think made them slightly uncomfortable.
Oh, I think they didn't know what was going on. And they've all admitted in this podcast and also at the Emmys for your consideration panel that they thought they were being fired.
Yeah.
They thought that their time with the show had come to an end, except for Manny, who thought he was being promoted. He thought you and Ted were leaving and that the babies were taking over. At that panel, you also talked, what is your concept of the universe? What do you think happens when we die?
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that there's some beautiful, loving force that's binding us all together. And that's what I feel in my day to day, where a feeling of like we're all one, kind of every baby in every country is my baby, too.
Right.
Feeling. But
I have a lot of babies.
I have so many babies. I have no forking clue.
You mentioned at the Emmy panel a few weeks ago that you feel as though at the beginning of the show you were one type of ethical philosopher and that your time with this project may have changed you.
Yeah. I think I was a little bit more utilitarian in the beginning, which is, I mean, the idea that you do what's good for the most amount of people. You know, if you have to push one person off a cliff to save a million, I mean, that's, look, it's a rough choice. But that was the easiest example that came to my head.
Sure.
Right? I'm not off base there.
No, that's correct.
But then the third, or maybe it was later than that, but one of the later philosophies that were exposed on the show was moral particularism with Jonathan Danzi, which is that it's not necessarily just Kantian, which is the technically the opposite of utilitarian, where it's you do the right thing in the moment no matter what. So you don't push that guy off the cliff because you don't want to push him off the cliff. That's wrong, even if the million people die. And these are all horrible decisions. But moral particularism is that there might not just be utilitarian or Kantian. It might be in the moment you sort of can decide. It's a particular decision for a particular event.
Why do you know this?
Because I'm on a show called The Good Place, and Mike downloads us with so much information each episode, and I retain it.
How does that was the thing, Chris? That was what Eleanor taught Chidi. That was the him, but like that's, you know, that was an episode when you guys were in the Bad Place Museum last year,
right? Where I said maybe it's not one or the. I was trying to let him off the hook, and what I was saying was, but what about moral particularism? Maybe it's not one or the other. Maybe you're okay that you made one decision and another decision because you're following what you think is good, and what he gets out of that is knowing that I was listening.
Mm-hmm.
So we sort of fall deeper into this connection because he was like, "You were paying attention."
Right. There are some beautiful moments when that happens. How did Mike pitch this show to you, Kristen? Do you remember?
I do. I had known Mike peripherally for 10 years, and very peripherally, but I had had so many friends that knew him and worked with him, and I had so much admiration for his work and who he was as a person from stories I'd heard. He called my answering machine. I was giddy.
This was in 1840?
This was in the year 1840. And he called my answering machine and he said, "Hey, Kristen, it's Mike Schur. I have this idea and I can't get you out of my head. I think it's got to be you. Do you want to sit down and talk?" I was over the moon and I said to my husband, I think he accidentally called me, but I'm so excited. I'm going to take the appointment, even if it wasn't meant for me.
It's Kristen Stewart.
I was going to say, which Kristen do you think he meant?
I don't care, because I somehow got the role. I came into his office, and the meeting was over 2 hours.
Holy cow.
He unrolled the entire first season, including the twist. Very few minor details were different, but he is such a riveting orator. He is so good at telling a story. His detail recall is off the charts. And I just sat there wide-eyed and listened. I signed on pretty much immediately. And it was just icing on the cake that he said, "And now when you think of Michael, think of, like, I want Ted Danson." And I just, my heart smiled, because I had done a movie about 2 years prior with Ted, and we became fast friends. And the idea of working with him on a daily basis just made me really happy. So it was a very easy sell. But I did not read a script. I just heard Mike's pitch.
Now, how does that work technically, like with your people and deals and memos and all that stuff? Like, do you call your people and go, "Mike's people are about to call, I'm in"?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I basically, yeah, because he bypassed everyone. So normally something comes through your agent,
sure,
and then you both read it and you decide it's worth meeting on and you speak to someone. He cold called my answering machine and I just went in. And I said to my agents, "I just met with Mike Schur. He gave me a great pitch. Call NBC and figure out whatever you need. I don't know what you do exactly, but do it."
Mm-hmm.
"And I would like to be on this show."
Morgan, you've worked with Mike before. You worked on Parks and Recreation. You've worked on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I know that you've produced Veep and even Seinfeld and directed on a lot of these shows.
Mm-hmm.
You produced Seinfeld?
I didn't. I got lunch on Seinfeld for a lot of different people.
With an associate producer credit, I feel.
Eventually.
Yeah.
No, I started as a PA on Seinfeld.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, good heavens.
Yeah.
How are things working out for you now?
I'd rather be getting lunch
with
people.
It is probably lower stakes than this. This show's different than other shows, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I'd worked with Mike and similar. I think it was before, you know, it was very early. Mike, we finished Parks and he wanted to take a break, but he doesn't ever really want to take a break. You know, so he started thinking of something. I think he even said earlier that the network kind of said, "Whatever you want to do, we'll do it."
Mm-hmm.
And I remember coming in and sitting in his bungalow. I assume, I don't know if that's where you met him when he pitched the story. And he started laying it out. I remember a few minutes in, it's like, oh my God, the afterlife and a lot of philosophy. And it's like, is this really good? But once he pitches the whole hour to you and he, you know, you had the twist, and it feels like he had about 11 out of the 13 episodes figured out.
Yeah.
At that point.
Why 13 episodes?
I don't know what he, I think it was just, it's I a know. Huge story.
Why is but, that?
And well,
some other...
well,
a couple reasons. Mm-hmm. A lot of people believe that when you're doing 22, 17 through 21 is mush and fluff to get you to 22.
Okay.
So from a writer's room perspective, I know there certain people believe that it's just, you're just writing to get to the end.
Mm-hmm.
Also, practically, I make a lot of decisions about my practical life. Like, I'm just so lucky that this show is good because I have such a good time working here on a daily basis. I don't even care if it's actually good when it hits the airwaves. I'm so excited to be with these people every day because, you know, you work with us. We have so much fun.
It's the best.
Ted and I had talked to Mike and both said, I don't think either of us are ready to have 22 episodes of work a year. It is a lot mm-hmm. of work. And I had, my youngest was 8 months at the time, and it wasn't a commitment I was willing to make because I've been on shows that were 22 episodes, 16 hours a day, and it was too much. I lost myself.
I don't have any doubt.
And if you remember, when I mean Parks, we did 22, 24, mm-hmm. and we ended with 13. And I think that's what we were coming off of. And Mike's like, that's the way to,
a
you don't
model.
Ever lose steam.
Yeah.
By the same token, on the flip side of that, it also has to be fairly finite confines. Like, you've got to tell this story and have these surprises and twists in only 13 episodes. I mean, it's got to work both ways, I would think.
Yeah, I think Mike certainly enjoys it because they have sort of a stronger perimeter. We enjoy it because we, you know, are not shooting 57 weeks a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of works for everyone. So we were just very lucky that NBC allowed us to shorten it.
I was going to ask about that. Like, did the network go, ooh, like, because they're
know.
In the content business, right?
Well, I think, I don't know. Honestly, I think they had picked up something sight unseen. They were probably glad that they didn't have to commit to more than 13. You know, they were
that's
like,
true.
Well, they'll be fine. I mean, I think once we got going, we started shooting very early. So we were really done shooting before we aired anything.
Right, I remember.
I feel after it was on, they may, you know, if we did have the option with you guys, they may have come to us and asked for more episodes. But that was like, we were shut down. It would have been incredibly expensive to put it all back together. So they were... I think they were fine, and with all the sports in the fall, and, you know, they're really...
That's right. There's a hiccup, yeah, or was.
There was
in the first two seasons.
Yeah, the first two seasons. So I felt like they were fine with it. I mean, I think maybe they'd have liked a couple more episodes. I think 14 or 16, but...
They didn't come back in season two and go, that worked, 22, please.
I can't... I
you wouldn't do it.
I can't. It's in my contract.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They have the ability to take us to 16.
16, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
And that's it.
And you've just laid out a lot of hope for fans of The Good
I know,
Place.
No,
yeah.
I wouldn't mind doing 16. I will say we're halfway through season three right now, and I'm already shocked.
Yeah, it feels
that
like we're just getting, yeah, we're
yeah.
just starting.
So. I wouldn't hate 16.
So tell everybody about season three. Don't. you've talked about sharing the planet as well, that we
yeah.
have to find a way to, you know, this is where we are.
Yeah,
for
no,
as
we
long
have
as...
to.
Yeah.
We absolutely have to figure out how to share this planet. yeah. The one real rule on Earth mm-hmm. is we all got to be here.
How much Eleanor Shellstrop was on the page? How much is old Kristen Bell?
Oh, no, I would never have the gall to be as bold as Eleanor. I am hyper self-aware. I walk into a room and my first thought is, does everyone like me? Who doesn't like me? How can I get them to like me?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm so glad to know that that's probably universal.
Yeah. So I am not, but it is so liberating to play a character that is the antithesis of that, that does not care who likes her. She is looking out for number one.
Yeah.
It's really, really fun because that's her truth.
Oh, yeah.
So the lines, her funniest lines are sincere.
Oh yeah.
Well, I don't care what you think. Those are sincere for her. And it just tickles me. Most of it, I mean, it was really on the page, you know. Drew Goddard directed our pilot, and Morgan was there and Mike was there, and I was just asking them, like, I could go big and bold with her, like someone who's a little bit more brash, or I can make her more contained. They tended to like the little bigger Eleanor, mm-hmm. but I just wanted to figure out someone real that wasn't, you know, phenomenally obnoxious and maintain some sense of charisma so that I could get the audience to root for her while she was doing all these sort of awful things.
Because she's a fairly terrible person.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
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 Well, you do it, and you accomplish that. And there are so many hard turns, so many tight turns that Eleanor has. The one you were just mentioning, you know, that this is her truth. Mm-hmm. The line that pokes out in this episode is you were saying something like about dishes, saying like, oh, this is so weird. These used to just magically be done in the morning. And Chidi's like, no, I did those. And for a moment, you're appreciative. And then you're like, what's the matter with these? Like, why are there dishes here now?
Yeah.
What's the matter with these bad boys?
Yeah. What's wrong with these bad boys? Yeah, that is. And when you subtract your desire to get people to approve of you and like you, you can say something like that sincerely. Well, why don't you do these ones?
Right.
You truly can deliver that. And it's funny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Morgan, the scale of this show is enormous. Does it make your heart pound as an executive producer when they're like, okay, so Tahani lives in a mansion, so we're going to need a mansion set. We're going to need a drawing room set. And then, of course, for things like this episode, it ends with, you know, one dude in a boat out in the middle of a lake, so you have to move the entire company to a lake.
Yeah, I don't know. The great thing about it is we have scripts really early,
okay.
And Mike's very flexible. It's sort of never say no, figure out a way to do it, you know. And I mean, from the beginning, the way I don't know, there was a lot of luck, the back lot being available.
I was going to ask about that.
And
that's a character in this piece, right?
Total character in the piece. And our original production designer, Dan Bishop, you know, the back lot, the European Village has been here forever, but it was really a wreck. And the studio had just spent, I don't know, quite a bit of money.
You're referring
it
to
up.
the town of the good place neighborhood that is on the Universal backlot,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Here in Universal City, California, yeah. in Los Angeles.
Where Yogurtville is, mm-hmm. all the yogurt shops.
Like, that's all real. That's all practical.
Yeah.
It's outside.
And
it's,
when we first started, we're like, we need a place like this. And we're like, maybe we'll shoot in Larchmont Village, which is an area in Los Angeles. And you go down there and there's like street signs and parking meters and storefronts and, you know, none of that stuff. There wouldn't be parking meters in the good place. There wouldn't be telephone
right.
poles. There wouldn't be... And luckily, the back lot, they just fixed up the buildings, which they were about to condemn. And instead, they made them, at least kept them standing. And then we spent a bunch of money painting them pastel colors. So that ate up a lot of our craziness that we had to figure out. But yeah, and then we had a great visual effects guy that I'd done a movie called Pop Star.
Oh, really?
And I met this guy, David Niednagel, on it. And he is just like the genius of all geniuses of visual effects, and he's also never say no to anything. And a lot of those guys are, they say no to everything.
And the cutest thing about Niednagel, by the way,
I
is
know what you're going
to
say. I was about to say it.
All his previs, yeah. which is the filmed version of what we were about to shoot that we receive, like, okay, here's my rough draft of this special effect. Here's what it's supposed to look like. And usually the special effects artist will, you know, tape it at home or something. He always uses his kids.
Yeah.
So he has these two beautiful daughters and they're always like flying across the room.
Reaching down each other's throats.
Reaching down each other's throats or
melting.
puking mm-hmm. up a bunch of pennies. Mm-hmm. And he just has his girls sit there and he's like, okay, stay there. And then he'll take those frames of the girls and then add all his special effects. So all the previs stuff we see are his adorable daughters.
Were you saying earlier, Morgan, that Universal was going to knock down that European...
Well, it was in such bad shape.
Really?
That they were sort of, we either need to knock it down or we need to just make the building safe.
Yeah.
And so that's what they did. They made them safe.
And you painted
and
them
And luckily, because when we, thinking on it, we're like, we can't shoot on the back lot. Everything's kind of falling down. The New York Street, which burned down, I don't know, 5-7 years ago, they'd rebuilt, but that didn't look right. And so they... they made this European Village strong enough to be inside of the buildings, and then we just took it over, and they were happy to have us do it.
And the raccoons did not move out.
No, they did
because
not.
Because those raccoons were there the
Wait,
whole
what?
Time. Oh, yeah, you know about
the
raccoons?
I don't know the raccoons.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're in all those buildings. So we'd set up our, you know, like where the hair and makeup chairs were, where we go get touch-ups or when we'd be
sure.
in the building out of the sun, and there'd just be raccoons walking by.
There are raccoons in our office building. Like Doug Smith, who is one of our producers, his office he came in one morning, there was a raccoon that had torn up his desk, and accounting, they pee through the ceiling. There's raccoons everywhere.
Pee through the ceiling?
They pee.
That's a lot of urine.
Yeah, a lot of urine.
They
would soak
volume.
The thing until it caved in on our accountant's desk.
Oh my
so,
God.
Yeah, it's heavy raccoons
oh, Hollywood.
Here at Universal.
You're so glamorous.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Kristen, you knew the twist going in.
Yes.
Ted knew the twist.
Yeah.
you know, the executive producers, Drew and Morgan and Mike, obviously. It was interesting to learn in the course of this podcast that many of the guest directors did not know. Mm-hmm. And of course, the cast didn't know. How did knowing that and knowing that the what they call what are sometimes called the babies, the other humans and Janet, mm-hmm. Didn't know. How did that influence or affect your performance?
It didn't really. I mean, I was able to, you know, put it in a little part of my brain that acknowledged that Mike has the utmost respect for people that he works with, and that when he pitched me this idea, he said to me, I'm going to give you the twist because I want you to know what you're signing up for. He is a true collaborator in every sense of the word. So he wasn't about to pull punches. He was going to say, here's exactly where we're going. Here's what I want to do with it. Here are the type of twists I'm going to do, and I'm going to give you the first season all right now. Mm-hmm. But he didn't need to do that. It was because he's a lovely, inclusive guy that
he's
he did.
All right.
Yeah, he's all right. And I didn't tell anyone. I didn't even tell my husband. And my husband's one critique of the show, halfway through, a little more than halfway through the first season, he said, I love your show. He goes, but I just feel like Ted is underused. He's just a little one note. And I couldn't tell him that's because you don't really know who Michael is.
Right.
That's because you've never seen Michael on screen alone, because you'd see he was a demon. You'd see his face shift. You'd see something.
Right.
He is playing a role. So I just kind of kept quiet.
I that's news that I wasn't aware of, that you hadn't told Dax about.
No.
Even like you signed on to a show and didn't tell him
yeah.
like the big reason that makes it interesting
yeah.
on an ongoing basis.
Well, that big reason was just Mike Schur. I was
okay.
just so excited.
I told Dax about it.
Is that right?
Yeah, he knew
Morgan.
Let's talk about that cool mushroom chair in Eleanor's apartment. Do you know, remember that that gray chair that's got, I think it's got a yoga ball in it?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
do you
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Of course I do. That's like mesh.
Yeah.
Everything in Eleanor's apartment, and this is truly a compliment to the art department, production designers, and prop department. Every single thing in Eleanor's apartment, if you go back and watch season one, is meant to be uncomfortable.
Interesting.
The statues look sharp.
They are.
They look cold.
Yeah.
The clowns are terrifying. The furniture looks uncomfortable.
It's
and
low.
That, yeah, it's either too low, it doesn't have a back, the cushions don't look welcoming or comfortable. Even the, you know, the art piece above Eleanor's bed is vaguely looks like barbed wire. Every single thing looks uninviting.
Yeah.
But when you put it all together and you have a smile on your face when you're talking in there, you don't recognize it, but there's all these layers to the show that fascinate me. Like in the first season, it might have been second season, I can't remember, we were working together as a team turning philosophy papers into Chidi.
Mm-hmm.
And we were handed our philosophy papers from the prop department before we shot the scene. And every philosophy paper had been written, an actual philosophy paper. Tahani's was titled something like, What I Learned from Claire Danes' Father-in-Law, Jonathan Dancy, about moral particularism. Jason's, Manny's, was written in three different types of ink, and it had Jason Mendoza, age 27, on the title page.
Morgan, you've brought on philosophy coaches, tutors, teachers
yeah.
to brief
consultants,
people.
Yeah.
Consultants, yeah. We started, and it wasn't, I don't think there was anyone, you know, Mike didn't, he read a lot of books in that spring and summer that we finished Parks.
Mm-hmm.
And
his desk was obnoxious.
It was.
With books.
It was crazy.
It was almost like he was showing off. There mm-hmm. were truly four books high, mm-hmm. eight books long, two books deep. And he was like, oh, yeah, I'm just reading all these.
Yeah.
It wasn't a fort. He hadn't built a fort.
No. It was, yeah, he really was. And I think he read them all because you would talk about something. He's like, that's in that one or something like that. He'd point to one of the books.
He's a strange bird.
And so I think there was a guy from Clemson who, Todd May, who he loved, who we Skyped with a few times. I don't think he came out until season two. There's a UCLA professor, you know, and then this year there was a Harvard professor that I won't tell you what the storyline is, but there was a different thing going on that, you know, so we sort of would find people, and we did that on Parks. We found city planners. We found a libertarian.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Ron Swanson?
Yeah. There was a woman who was a Burbank city councilwoman who was a total libertarian, hated government. And, you know, she said, I see the irony. And I think we gave that to Ron at some point. So we had sort of done that with other, you know, other things. And so we found not as many of these people, but we'd find three or four and then a lot of books.
Because the internet will come for you, right?
Yes.
Like you can't just put out
right.
a Wikipedia,
yeah.
You know, cursory thing. They the universe wants to know that you understand it.
And so different now that Chidi's board had to have the proper stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. before now everybody pauses everything and reads everything. And
zooms
and
in.
Speaking, you know, I think our props people on parks used to do this where they'd write up every document. But now you have to because people will pause it and read the document if there's ever a clear. And they love it if you put jokes in those things.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
The early on, I remember it being the I myself froze it because, as you said, the show didn't air until we were done shooting. So when it was, you know, points totals, what was plus and minus points, I definitely zoomed
that
in.
That one in that Michael's sort of video, that we changed up until like the day before we aired. We kept changing out point totals and, you know, what would get pluses and minuses.
And the yogurt shop, when you order and you're able to see all 400 different types of yogurts and some are like a nap, full cell phone
folded
charge.
Folded laundry, right?
I think that was this episode.
Folded laundry.
About,
Oh, yeah, was it that one?
That's this one.
Amazing when you, I remember taking pictures of it on my phone just to remember all of the good food.
And then we extended it. David Neednagle extended it.
I was going to say, so some of that's practical
there
and actually
are,
on the wall.
Probably 100 and some on the wall. And then there were, I don't know, 500 in the actual, you know, we visual effected it down and wrote all of the other ones.
This is the strangest show on television. I love it so much. There were clues, you know, when you look back and rewatch these episodes, having seen the episode 113 twist, Eleanor has a line in this episode where she says, every ounce of my happiness leads to a ton of pain for you. Like, now looking back, you can see that there was a torture matrix that, you know, any imbalance in any direction caused someone some benefit or some demise. That, I don't know. It's just such a fascinating show.
It's deep, right?
It's deep, dude. I mean, I didn't tell my wife either anything, and she loved the show and was very angry.
When did you find out that it was?
I got it all in one go.
Right.
Mike gave me everything, this bananas premise of the show, and then the complete undoing, the ruining of this premise of the show. And then I go and I get in that van into the second row of a 15-passenger, and the first row is Ted Danson, who turns around and goes, do you have any questions? And yeah, dude, I've got a billion questions. And then I realized in that drive to the to the train station, I mentioned something fairly specific, and Ted sort of motioned to the driver of the van and said, like, shush. And I was like, the crew doesn't know? And he's like, nobody knows.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing that I want to talk about again, you said some of all of our guest directors didn't know. And Morgan, what was the term that we used? And it was particularly in reference to Ted.
Mm-hmm.
He said, like, does this relate? He wanted to make sure that it was working for Michael as Michael was before episode 10, before the twist was revealed, or 13. God. And then also that it tracked with Michael as the demon.
Sure.
Right. So he would say, is this...
Oh, what was it?
It wasn't
like macro and micro, but it was something
like
that.
No, but it was something like that. Like, is this our...
Big picture endgame.
It was essentially...
it was something like that. Like, is this our endgame or today's game? And then, anytime he talked about the end game, he would, the guest director, they'd wait for the guest director to leave, and Ted would only be speaking to like Morgan and the writer just to make sure that he was tracking Demon Ted correctly because we couldn't tell the guest directors.
Because this is CIA level.
Well, it was, you know, who knows? It was for their own protection.
Yeah.
Of course, we learned later Ted was the only one telling everybody. But
truly, he was the only one spilling the beans around the whole city
but
of
we
Los
didn't
Angeles.
But we didn't want anyone else to blow it in.
I'm fascinated with code words, so if you do remember it, interrupt anything that's happening
and
tell us.
I'll try to remember.
Let's listen to a clip.
They're gonna catch us. This is an extremely precarious situation. I am vexed, Eleanor.
A marriage counselor and a human lie detector isn't my first choice for company either, but they have no reason to suspect us. Plus, I think they may have actually just come here to, you know, swing. I say we do it. It'll get them to stop asking questions.
No, I am not going to have sex with someone to get them to stop talking to me.
Really? You and I are very different.
Yeah, I noticed.
You know what, man? I have spent every second in this place worried I was going to get caught. But if we go down right now, that's on you, okay? Oh, you spend all your time teaching a charming, awesome lady. How sad for you. Face it, dude. I'm the best thing that ever happened to you. Because guess what, Chidi? You basic.
This clip comes from episodes found on Amazon, Google Play, and iTunes, and watch recent episodes on the NBC app. Had you ever said you're basic before?
Oh, not sincerely to anyone.
Sure.
No, but I've said it twice, three times on this show with the utmost sincerity. Once as a compliment.
Oh, I don't remember that. What was that?
That hasn't been aired yet.
Oh.
That's all I can say.
Okay.
Morgan's giving me the stink eye.
Yeah. Morgan's the logic cup.
No, Eleanor, that is a good, solid burn in Eleanor's book. It might be her number one burn.
It's a pretty great burn.
Yeah, it's a great burn.
Do you know the story of where it came from?
Is it the online video of the boy saying, calling all the basic bitches?
I don't think.
There's a new announcement.
No. I don't know what you're talking
about. Yeah, basic. No?
Oh, that's amazing.
Oh, I love that one.
Podcast listeners will have to wait until... Oh, good heavens, season two. When Jen Statsky tells the story, it was Darcy Carden and Jen Statsky's story, and I will leave it there. The second time that Eleanor says it was an unforgettable moment in episode 113 because it's the reset. And I can remember being in the room when you get through the B of bass and Ted snaps.
Yeah.
And we could all feel in the room like, 13 episodes of premise going away forever.
Yeah.
Like
evaporating.
It was really strong. It was a palpable and odd thing.
Well, anytime you have someone on the edge of their seat not knowing what's going to happen next, they are paying attention. Their brains are open and ready for new information. That is the ideal audience member. And I think Mike and the writers know that.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know. Story is the only commodity in Hollywood, right? And and content, and we just let it go. Like, I can remember feeling like, I've said this 1,000 times, but saying to Mike, are you sure?
Yeah. And he said, Mike, sure.
Right.
I don't know if you remember the table read of 113 in a room very similar to this place. The network, I mean, they liked it, but they were sort of, are you sure? Do you want to shoot? They wanted us to shoot
an alternate.
Alternate ending to season one.
What was it? I remember that.
We didn't have one. And we just kept kind of, we said, we'll talk about it, you know?
You lied.
I think they just, they loved it and they loved the pitch from the beginning of the season. But I think they got a little nervous. And they were like, yeah, what is this going to be next year? And Ted, who's, people loved him and he's a demon. And yeah, so they asked to come up with one. And then I think they thought about it for a few days and they never pressed us for it.
But. So wait a second. This makes me think you would have been shooting this long before it aired.
Yeah, I don't think nothing had aired.
And therefore, long before there was ever a chance of a season two pickup, right? It had not a frame had aired yet.
No, not picked up and not, yeah. And we were done shooting in early August, maybe, something like that.
But those are the best ideas. Mm-hmm. The ones you take a chance on that you really have those butterfly feelings. Is this correct? I mean, no one ever got anywhere from being safe. It's like, people experimenting with bacteria in petri dishes, don't put that by the window. Boom, penicillin. Do you know what I mean? The biggest breakthroughs were times when you just threw caution to the wind and said, I trust that this is going to be great. And they needed to trust Mike's brain and the writer's brain. And it was important to let that go so that the world could truly open up.
It's such a good lesson, I think, to make bold choices. Like if you go beige, if you go lukewarm, you don't really get anywhere. But by going bold, you almost never have to backtrack if you make strong choices in creative directions.
Yeah, and even if it fails, at least you tried. That was a great first fail. You know, it's like when you're writing something, just try. Go big. Go weird.
And you're starting a band called Boom Penicillin.
Yeah,
is that right?
Boom Penicillin. we're going to be in 38 states as of December this year, you guys.
Too bad for those 12. In this episode, Bart and Nina are such a great, almost perjury trap. Like their characters, their backstories for what they did on Earth, being a marriage counselor and basically a private investigator trained in body language and catching people pretending to be people that they're not. Again, this is just another example of such a great torture matrix. But the fact that, the second that Eleanor and Chidi were going to separate from one another, Michael comes on and says, don't leave the room, nobody go outside, and then later introduces these two to just turn up the heat.
And they were so jolly, and, but he's like, my previous career is for the FBI, or with the agency, he said, I think, or something. It was so great. I mean, we used that again then in season two.
I forgot where that
Ted's
is.
Ted's outside the door with him when it's sort of flashing
they're giggling.
They're giggling like, and I'll say I'm a, relationship specialist or whatever it was. And then we push through the door into the scene. I mean, we were definitely ramping up like the scenarios were really torturing people. Like, get them in a fight and now trap them in a house with people that are a relationship person and a FBI, you know, agent.
And of course, all those weird interior windows make sight lines. There's nowhere to hide in Eleanor's house.
No.
Yeah. Not if you don't close those clown doors.
That's right.
Kristen, I have some listeners' questions, some internet questions for you.
Okay.
People are curious about what were some of your Arizona trash bag lines that were difficult to get through?
None.
Really?
Zero.
Really?
They were all perfect.
Okay.
Eat my farts?
Yeah.
Do you have a minute to eat my farts? I mean, I didn't even know how badly I wanted to say that to someone.
Mm.
Because Kristen would never let herself say something like that.
Would it even come to mind?
No, for fear of, I wouldn't let myself get there for fear of that person having a poor opinion of me. But all of Eleanor's trash bag lines and when she, what do they talk about? The environmental guy looking like a sickly Victorian boy, but he's still super hot. I mean, like you really want to feed him soup. It's just a perspective that is like the cattiest, sassiest perspective that's running in the back of your mind that you can never say out loud. And it's fun to say those things out loud.
It's a good out loud, right? For, I mean, it's literally an alter ego.
Yeah.
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 Favorite, least favorite parts of growing up in Michigan?
Oh, favorite, lightning storms.
Oh, yeah.
And fireflies. Least favorite, mosquitoes. I mean, they're both relating to the outdoors because you spent a lot of, as you know, time in the outdoors in Michigan. I loved growing up in Michigan, though. I do. And we have taken our kids back a couple times.
Dax is from there, too.
Yeah. We're from 20 minutes apart, but we did not know each other when we were there. But we rented a house on Lake Michigan two summers ago so that they could be eaten alive by mosquitoes and see the fireflies. And it's lovely.
A lot of people asked if you and they could be besties. I let them know that that was me.
Okay. yes.
Also, people were curious about your favorite episode, if you have one, and if you would consider directing.
I don't know that I'm qualified to direct yet. I might be.
You would do fine.
Well, if Morgan, if you put me in your pocket, I might do fine. Look, I'm paying attention. Let me leave it at that. I don't actually start anything or attempt anything that I don't feel 150% confident at. I would not say, let me direct an episode because I know we have a lot of qualified directors that have been working very hard on their career, honing their voice and directing, and I have been doing the same for acting. So I wouldn't want to step up to the plate unless I felt really qualified and like I really wanted to do it. And I'm not quite there yet, but I am paying a lot of attention. I shadow Morgan and I shadow Dean and I sit close to Video Village all the time because I'm getting there. The match has been lit. I don't know if it's a fire yet, but
sure.
I think I would enjoy it. And I actually think, I'm not even just saying this, this might have been my favorite episode so far.
Wow.
Because I loved the tension in the house. I love when it's great to depend on huge production value and it gets you so far with the visuals and stuff, but the fact that we were really just in the house and Bart and Nina made us so uncomfortable and Chidi and I had that great fight where I said basic to him and then it ended with a truly lovely moment by that lake that was really connected where Eleanor did a nice thing. Mm-hmm. This was probably my favorite episode because I will say, to toot Morgan's horn, this was, when everyone watched this cut, everyone's like jaw was on the ground. They were like, oh my gosh, Morgan is so great.
I don't know about that, but
I do.
It was fun. I mean, we were
it's
in the,
said.
The second season. I did one that was the Team Cockroach, which was all in the house and all explaining. So yeah, it's funny that I scout and find all these great locations. And then the ones I end up directing are all locked in the house. And we have one coming up in season three that is a, can't talk about it, but it's very confined.
So good.
It's so good.
You can't talk about it, but it's so good.
It will make these confined ones feel like nothing.
And maybe it's never been done on television?
I don't know.
You know, it's never been done on television.
I know what we're talking about, and I am uncomfortable.
And I will say, just to add a little bit a layer of reality, remember we were shooting at the lake. And I remember that day so specifically because I came in panicked because I had spent the morning with my youngest daughter and she fell into like a super soft chair. mm-hmm. like the softest chair you could imagine, and split her chin open.
Oh, no.
It didn't even make sense to me, but I had to take her to like an emergency doctor to sew her chin up, which made me very, and I was rushing to get to work, but I was obviously not going to leave my 12-month-old child for any reason to go with a babysitter to the doctor. So I rushed to get to work. And we shot this beautiful scene on the lake, and it was like sunset. And then I overhear someone saying, oh, yeah, there's bacteria in this lake. They just tested for it. Do not go in the lake. It'll kill your dog. It will literally kill your dog. Because that lake, it was by Toluca Lake or something?
No, it's Franklin Canyon. Franklin. It's a reservoir at the top of Coldwater.
But something had
infected
the lake.
One that we drink from?
Yeah.
It was a bacteria-riddled lake, and like dogs had been passing away from getting it in their skin and stuff. So they were like, don't touch the lake. I was like, okay, got it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And you deliberately scouted that location, Morgan?
Well, we didn't try very hard. I don't know if the lake was quite that poisonous, but
you
probably.
You said that Kristen would be fine directing.
She'd be great.
Is directing this show different than other things you've directed?
It is. I mean, there's different things to keep in mind, and there's, you know, I mean, I've done a lot of comedy. There's not mm-hmm. a lot of visual effects in comedy generally.
Right.
There's not. I think a lot of it is this. I think a lot of people would be fine directing this show because our crew is so dialed in, and there's a lot of support.
And no ego. Like, there's no panic
zero.
On this show. Yeah. There's no,
zero.
And I think a lot of that, that's the way I like to work with all the people I work with. The same with Mike. It's like, mm-hmm. it's hard work. You know, you spend a lot of hours doing this and adding a lot of stress to it and claiming ownership. I mean, if the show's good, everyone's going to benefit, and you don't need to, you know, say I did it all or anything like that.
But I'll just take the mic here for a second. Morgan does do it all. And everyone in this city knows that Morgan runs every cool comedy mm-hmm. around. And like when I say his name in other meetings or to other people, you're so capable as a producer that can do anything. And he's just batting his eyes like he doesn't even know that. He knows in his heart that he can do anything, but
for sure.
he does not have an ego about it, which is what makes him so lovely to be around. But you could say, so it's, what day is it? Wednesday. By Friday, I need a huge circus set, and right. I need 4 cameras and 2 crane rigs.
Live animals.
And he'll be like, okay, and what time on Friday? I mean, it's like he's
it's
so
real.
Casual about it. It's unreal.
And I just told this story moments before we started recording that all of that can be going on and Morgan will see me, a contract employee, and come over and be like, how have you been? It's like, you don't have time for how I've been. You don't have time for me. How are you doing this?
How do you do it, Morgan?
Yeah, why are you so weird?
What are your secrets?
Yeah, what's going on?
Are you
really
human?
I don't know. Barely. No, I don't know. It just...
It's what you're meant to do?
It's meant to do, I guess. It just, I don't get, I mean, I think I am stressed out inside, but I don't spend a lot of energy worrying about it. Just like go forward and figure it
What's
out.
What's your
That's
concept of the universe? Yeah,
he
why?
Doesn't waste any energy.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you fear death?
Yeah, I think I do more now that I have kids.
Oh, sure.
You know, like I don't think I ever thought about it much. And you sort of feel you're immortal when you have, I have a 14-year-old and an 11-year-old and, you know, they ask these questions. Mm-hmm. And it's just as uncomfortable as you asking these questions. So I don't know.
What I think is a particularly unusual combination is that you can do all the administrative, planning, scheduling stuff, and then also are creative enough to direct television.
Yeah, that's very unique about you, Morgan.
Yeah,
do you think your brain works differently? Like, do you find that your brain works in a certain way that you can identify, like, well, when I do this, I do this? Or because you can multitask to a degree that's almost inhuman, but also allow yourself to have like a creative flow and think up new fun ideas.
I don't know. I feel like this morning we were at a place. I can't say where we were doing what, but this is very weird.
Me and Morgan, not even the crew.
Yeah. Oh, that's
just
very,
us.
Oh,
we
yeah.
were
very.
Out
okay,
this
it's
morning.
Brunch. It was Hugo's and Still Look Like, whatever. And I'll dive in. I mean, it's fun to direct because, I'll be in for a couple hours and I'll weigh in on what's going on in the scene, but I'm always trying to be very respectful of the director of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's Dean or somebody who's directed a lot of them. And, but, when you direct, you're there for the whole week. And when we wrap, I go and deal with other things. But when you're on the set, it's really fun to, and to, like, Kristen is great, and I don't know if she remembers, I did direct her in Parks for one scene, I think.
That's right.
I did the episode where Leslie's on roller skates the whole time, and you come
the
in at the
hallway scene?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I pitched her this bizarre inside joke, and I'd never met Kristen before, and there'd been this scene that we'd done, and I just pitched her this bizarro line, like, you know, I don't know, something about sex that it turned, I don't know, it was this really weird thing. I read it to her, and she's like, great, I'll just do it. And she repeated it perfectly. She had no idea what it was, but.
Pro.
Because I knew, I looked into his eyes, and I knew I could trust him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's, and as much as you multitask and as much as you say you're not, you know, you're only there for the beginning, I feel like you're omnipresent because I know, because he's also the most get a hold of person. Is that a word?
Mm-hmm.
Person
yeah.
you're able to get a hold of?
Yeah, accessible.
And, accessible, thank you. There's a word in the English language for it. The most accessible person because I text him if it's a problem or a compliment or I'm hungry, he texts right back.
Back to getting lunch for people.
Yeah.
How often does Kristen Bell text you, I'm hungry?
No, more than you would think.
Is that right? Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
And it can't just be anything. It's got to be the proper products.
Yep.
Like this water would not stand. If no. I brought her one of these.
No.
We won't mention what it is.
Morgan Sackett, what's good?
I should cede my time to the lady from Michigan.
Do you want to think on it?
I'll think on
answer.
It. Go ahead.
Kristen Bell, what's good?
What's good?
What's good?
I think self-care is good.
Oh.
I've learned that throughout the course of my life. I think, I mean, goodness is good, philanthropy is good, being kind is good, but I think self-care for me is the most good. To recognize when you are ignoring yourself because self-esteem, which is the fuel for everything and a happy attitude, can only come from within if you're fulfilled. And self-care is a mandatory part of that.
I think it's a good lesson to learn that self-care isn't greed.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose people could, you could twist it in an argument that way. But self-care is, I love my children more than anything I've ever thought I could love. And I need a break sometimes.
Sure.
And I need a 30-minute walk or I need to have dinner with a girlfriend. And I love my husband. And sometimes I need to go get a pedicure without him. And sometimes I love my work, but I need a date night with my husband. Self-care is sort of the balance of all the different pieces of the mosaic that make up you and making sure you're attentive to all of them. And not feeling shameful when you need to give one a little bit more attention because it's been ignored, especially if that's, I need to just go read a book with myself right now because I'm feeling introverted.
Self-care.
Yeah,
I like
self-care.
It. Anything?
Not really. No, I think just being, I don't know, I think the one thing that relaxes me is just being in the water and going to the ocean.
Oh, wow.
With, you know, and my son is a fish, and so that's sort of when I really am stressed out, which I don't show very often, it's just go get in the water.
Do you surf or just swim? Or
surf and
really?
Paddleboard and then just sometimes my son just likes to swim out into the waves and float.
There is something restorative and magical about the ocean.
Yeah.
For sure. Morgan, may I please have one of the cards that says fork off, Eleanor?
Mm-hmm.
Are those available?
Yeah.
I don't understand why NBC doesn't sell all of these things in an online store.
By the way, I have been saying this. The sweatshirts that say Po Body's Nerfect?
Mm-hmm.
Come on.
Dress bench.
Dress bench. There was, I mean, all we've had a couple different t-shirts. Welcome Everything is Fine
mm-hmm.
was one that I got from Wardrobe at the beginning of the mm-hmm. second season. I made the crew t-shirts from my very favorite line in season two when I was about to go to the Rihanna concert with my girlfriend from Arizona. I opened up the door and I said to her, what's up, dong bait?
Yeah.
And I obviously made the crew what's up, dong bait t-shirts. that was, yeah, they have a lot of sellable items here. Oh, and if I can just mention, because I asked Ted what our word was when we would have to speak in front of the guest directors. It was, what is the objective of this scene? And then whispered, it was, what is the super objective?
Right.
Objective and super objective.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, this show is unusual.
But also Ted, who's the greatest, would also love talking about it sometimes, even if it wasn't that important to the
right.
scene. Or I think maybe Ted was sort of stalling so he could read his lines.
Oh.
But he loved
that's an actorly move.
He's such a great guy. But yeah, he liked being on the inside, and little do we know, he was telling everybody in the world.
Yeah.
Morgan Sackett, Kristen Bell, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you so much for doing these.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Go do something good.
Hi there. The podcast is over. I think what I'm feeling is sadness.
Oh, don't worry, Janet. This podcast is the most perfectly engineered invention since the paperclip.
Fun fact, the man who invented the paperclip is in The Bad Place for tax evasion.
It's available on Apple Podcasts and all major podcasting platforms, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop saying podcasts.
Hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Written by Lizzie Pace.
Music composed by David Schwartz. Yay!